From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we examine some of the conspiracies and covert actions in the news. The BCCI banking conspiracy, the Iran-Contra affair, and the October surprise. We talk with Stansfield Turner, who was the director of Central Intelligence during the Carter administration. Also today, we take a closer look at BCCI with the reporter who's been covering it for Time magazine, Jonathan Beatty. And TV critic David Bianculli looks back on 10 years of MTV. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir said today that he will recommend to his cabinet that the government attend a peace conference sponsored by the U.S. and the Soviet Union. The final decision will still be subject to a solution to the question of Palestinian representation at the meeting. Patricia Golan reports from Jerusalem.
After a one-and-a-half-hour meeting with Secretary of State James Baker, who flew to Israel directly from Moscow, where the United States and Soviet Union announced their joint efforts to try to convene a Middle East peace conference in October. The issue that was holding up Israeli agreement to talk was the question of whether Arab residents of Israeli-annexed East Jerusalem could be part of the Palestinian delegation to talk. It's still unclear how this sensitive issue will be resolved, but Israeli Foreign Minister David Levy claims there was complete understanding between Israel and the U.S. Secretary Baker said this was the yes he was waiting for. He will sign a memorandum of understanding with Israel, setting out what has been agreed between Israel and the U.S. to reassure Israel about the future course of the peace process. Where and how talks will take place has not yet been decided. For National Public Radio, this is Patricia Golan in Jerusalem.
The African National Congress called on South Africa's white minority government to resign today in the midst of a growing scandal over secret government funding of rival black groups. The call was the ANC's first formal response to President F.W. de Klerk's efforts to contain the scandal. De Klerk demoted two of his cabinet members after it was disclosed that the government funded political rallies held by the ANC's major rival, the Inkatha Freedom Party. The ANC said today that that wasn't enough, and that an interim government should be established to oversee the transition to a racially integrated democracy. Following an escalation of ethnic violence in the Yugoslav Republic of Croatia, the parliament is expected to begin debate later tonight on possibly declaring a state of war. NPR's Silvia Poggioli reports from Zagreb.
The Croatian parliament began meeting in a special session this morning to debate a new government of national unity, a more moderate cabinet than the previous one. But as the day went on, reports began coming in of violent clashes in the eastern part of Croatia. Three villages were attacked by rebel Serbs who live in the area and, reportedly, by the Federal Army, which was said to have moved in with heavy tanks. At least three people were reported killed and 20 wounded. This evening, Croatian officials ordered reinforcements and heavy munitions sent to the critical areas. In the last week, Croatia has suffered increasing territorial losses to the Serbs and a mounting wave of refugees. This evening, angry deputies challenged the new government's moderate policies as many parliamentarians called for a state of war. In Zagreb, this is Silvia Poggioli.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 7 points to close at 3,017.67. This is NPR News. The building industry saw a modest increase in new construction spending in June, recovering slightly from a decline the month before. The Commerce Department reported that total spending on construction was up by 0.3%. The report said that the gains were a result of new home building and the start of new public works projects. New single-family homes led the growth in housing, whereas spending on new apartment projects actually fell during June. Analysts said that's because the rental market is still suffering from overbuilding during the 1980s. Today's planned liftoff of the space shuttle Atlantis has been called off because of bad weather. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE reports.
This morning's planned 11 o'clock Eastern Time liftoff was first delayed by a slight mechanical failure. The retesting of that hardware in question allowed the weather to become a major concern. Winds picked up and a band of strong thunderstorms began moving toward the Cape. Launch director Bob Seek.
Based on the dynamic condition of the weather and the fact that we're expecting it to deteriorate
Apollo's launch window will open at 11:02 Eastern and remain open for just over 4 hours. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida.
A key index of the manufacturing sector showed that activity in the nation's factories grew in July at the fastest pace in more than 2 years. The National Association of Purchasing Management said that its index rose by almost a full point to 51.8%. A reading above 50% indicates that the manufacturing sector is growing. The measure is based on a monthly survey of the executives who buy raw materials and supplies for factories across the country. According to the Purchasing Managers Index, the economy snapped out of its year-long decline in June and continued rising in July. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Kind of overwhelming, isn't it, the number of stories in the news about conspiracies and scandalous covert operations? There's the BCCI international banking conspiracy, new investigations into the October surprise, and renewed interest in the Iran-Contra affair now that a former CIA official has confessed that he withheld information from Congress under orders from his superiors. Seems like an interesting time to talk to a former director of Central Intelligence. My guest is Admiral Stansfield Turner, who served as CIA chief in the Carter administration. When Turner took over in 1977, Congress had just completed an investigation into past excesses within the CIA. He tried to reform the agency's image. For 444 days, he worked for the release of Americans held hostage by Iran. His new book, Terrorism and Democracy, is about how American presidents have dealt with terrorists. The American hostages were released shortly after President Reagan was sworn into office. I asked Turner if he believes there was a so-called October surprise, that Reagan aides cut a deal with Iran to withhold the release of American hostages until after the election, in exchange for shipments of American arms to Iran.
I think it's unfair to jump to that conclusion because the evidence is only circumstantial. In recent months, the amount of circumstantial evidence has been growing, however. We've reached the point where the nation needs to have this problem put to bed. I just cannot understand why the White House doesn't do that by adducing the necessary documentation to show where various people were at the times they are alleged by some to have been involved in making deals with the Iranians.
When you were the director of Central Intelligence during the hostage crisis, were you approached by the Iranians to make an arms for hostages deal?
No, I was not. We knew that two other campaigns were, that is, the campaign of John Anderson for president and the campaign of Ronald Reagan. We never had any inclination that a deal was being made, however.
Why do you think that they were approached and you weren't?
Well, there were constant discussions going on between us, that is, the administration and the Iranians, over these hostages. They never came to us and specifically said they wanted arms for the hostages. But we had frozen a whole lot of arms the Shah had paid for before Khomeini took office. And President Carter had made it clear when he froze those that they would be released when the hostages were returned. So the Iranians didn't need to make a bargain with us. They had an implicit understanding here that if they released the hostages, the arms would be delivered.
Was President Carter on the verge of negotiating any kind of release?
Yes, we were negotiating from almost day one. President Carter was leaning heavily on the negotiating option, particularly in December, January, February 79-80. We just couldn't find anyone in Iran who could make a deal with us. We had great debates over what would fit within the national honor, what would ensure that we really would get the hostages out if we made some kind of a deal, and what would not set a undue precedent for future hostage-taking. We never could come to the right mix, nor could we find the people with enough authority inside Iran. Those negotiations resumed after the rescue operation in September of 1980, when it was the Iranians who came to us and said they wanted to work out a deal, and they wanted it to be consummated before the election of November 4th, 1980.
What kind of deal did they suggest?
They wanted to get the hostages returned to us. They wanted to get us to relinquish financial claims against them for the hostage situation. They wanted us to return money that we had frozen of theirs that was in our banks in this country and abroad. We worked very close, I think, to coming to some agreement there when one of two things happened. Either the Iranians, because they had dissension in their own ranks about the desirability of a deal, stumbled around and couldn't get their own act together until 2 days before the election, and then they made a proposal to us that was totally unacceptable. Or the Reagan administration did make a deal behind the scenes, and the Iranians deliberately postponed coming to any conclusion with the Carter administration past Election Day.
And you're beginning to think that the latter really was a possibility.
You're putting words in my mouth.
I thought that's what you said earlier.
No, I did not say that. I very carefully avoided saying that. I said there is more circumstantial evidence today than there was a year ago. That means that I think we want to get an investigation of some sort that gets to the bottom of this, or preferably the necessary disclosures from the White House. I do not want to be associated with any accusation that there was an October surprise deal made by the Reagan administration. I think it's such a terrible thing to accuse anybody of that I don't want to do that on the basis of circumstantial evidence.
I stand corrected. Thank you.
Surely.
For just joining us, my guest is Stansfield Turner, who was the director of Central Intelligence from 1977 to 81, and he's written a new book called Terrorism and Democracy. In your book, you say that presidents are always saying that they do not make deals with terrorists, but presidents sometimes really do make deals with terrorists. And you say that deals are an option we can't really rule out, but some deals are less objectionable than others. What are your standards about when it's appropriate to make a deal with terrorists and what kind of deal is appropriate?
First, you ask yourself, will this deal achieve what I want? Will it get my hostages back or whatever it may be? Sometimes you can't be sure of that. Secondly, what will it do to our national honor? Are we lowering ourselves here in the eyes of the entire world? And thirdly, will this give such a reward to the terrorists that it will actually incite them to do more terrorism? Is it so obvious to them that by taking some more hostages, they can get some more of whatever we gave them in this deal? So you have to weigh these three factors. A deal such as President Lyndon Johnson made, in which he signed a false confession saying that a U.S. Navy ship had intruded into North Korean waters in order to get hostages out, was not a bad deal, because Johnson even stood up before the signing and said, I'm only signing this because I want to get the hostages out. A deal of arms for hostages, that kind of a deal has a lot of hazard, because we obviously have an almost infinite supply of weapons, and if they want more, they can go out and take hostages.
So elaborate for me on where you think the Iran-Contra arms for hostages deal would fit into your standards of what's an appropriate deal to make with terrorists.
I think that was not an appropriate deal because, first of all, it didn't pass my first test. That is, would it be effective? The Iranians didn't release hostages in all six of the deals we made for arms. They only released them on three of those occasions. And in between, they took three more hostages. So we weren't getting anything out of this. Secondly, it clearly violated our moral standing in the world, because at the very time we were making these deals behind the scenes, we were urging our allies not to sell arms to Iran. And thirdly, it didn't meet the other criterion, because the Iranians simply would take more hostages if they wanted more arms for us. It was just too obvious a deal.
Alan Fiers was chief of the CIA Central America Task Force from 84 to 88 during the Iran-Contra happenings. He recently pleaded guilty to charges of withholding information from Congress under orders from his superiors. How far do you think the trail of guilt will lead within the CIA?
Well, it's very difficult to tell, because Mr. Casey had a very unorthodox management arrangement. He didn't use a chain of command, it appears. He skipped around and dealt directly with people at various levels in the agency, so I don't know that we can tell by outside judgment as to how many people were implicated in this. Certainly, a lot more people were involved than have been either brought before the courts or brought before discipline within the CIA.
William Casey was your successor as the head of the CIA. How would you characterize his style of leadership?
Well, his style was one of swashbuckling and disregard for laws and rules, in my opinion, as is indicated by the fact that he was criticized by his own superior, Ronald Reagan, after the fact. When Ronald Reagan got out of the Iran-Contra affair, he made a new rule for CIA covert actions. He said they must be things of which this country would be proud if the people did know about them. Of course, they're done in secret, so the people don't know of them. But that new rule that the president put out was an implied criticism of Mr. Casey for having done covert actions on a different basis. He was also criticized by his confrere, the Secretary of State, Mr. Shultz, who in the Iran-Contra hearings testified that long before Iran-Contra broke, he had come not to trust much of the intelligence he was receiving, indicating he thought Mr. Casey was putting a spin on this, a political spin. And it doesn't make any difference whether Shultz is right or wrong in that accusation. If a Secretary of State doesn't trust the intelligence he's receiving, you and I are wasting millions and millions of dollars in producing that intelligence, which is not going to be used.
Whoever the next director of the CIA is, he'll have to steer the agency in a post-Cold War world. How do you think the CIA's function will need to be redefined?
Well, first of all, we will give less attention to the Soviet Union, and it's difficult for me to emphasize how much the Soviet Union has dominated intelligence over the last 46 years. Secondly, we will give less attention to military matters because of this decline of the Soviet military threat. That means we're going to have to look around and see if there are other challenges that this country needs to confront. And one, of course, we all recognize today is the economic challenge to our country.
What's the CIA's role in economic battles between countries? What do you see the CIA doing in that?
I think the CIA has the role here as it does in military intelligence. Find out what's going on in the rest of the world. Find out what other people's game plans are. How do we protect our interests against people who are doing economic warfare against us? A lot of countries have what are called mercantilist policies, where the government deliberately pushes its commerce, its industry in particular directions, like, let's say, selling a particular product overseas at a loss for a few years in order to gain a majority of the market share and then raise the price and dominate the market. We want to know if that kind of thing is going on. We don't want to get caught short as we did in the early 1970s, for instance, when the Soviets had a very bad grain harvest. But before they announced that to the world, they came out and they bought all of our grain that they could at cheap prices, and the price immediately skyrocketed once we found out that they had this bad harvest. Since then, the CIA has predicted the Soviet grain harvest better than the Soviets do, and we don't get caught out anymore. There are lots of ways like these that the CIA, our whole intelligence community, can contribute to the well-being of our commercial enterprises.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Stansfield Turner, who was director of Central Intelligence from 1977 to 81. He's written a new book called Terrorism and Democracy. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Former CIA Director Stansfield Turner is my guest. The CIA director, William Webster, has ordered a review of any CIA ties to the BCCI, the Bank of Credit and Commerce International. And this is the bank that was used by terrorists, dictators, arms merchants, and governments carrying out covert wars. Did you ever use the BCCI when you were head of the CIA?
I had no knowledge of the BCCI when I was head of the CIA.
When did you find out about the BCCI?
Well, a few weeks ago in the papers, or a few months ago.
You never knew about it until then?
Nope. That seems to leave you stunned, I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, it does.
No, I did not have any knowledge of it while I was in the CIA.
Now, you said that you didn't know anything about the BCCI until recently, but could you help explain what kind of special banking needs there are when you're fighting a secret war that would lead everybody who's been using the BCCI to use it?
No, I'm not going to be able to explain to you the intricacies of funding agents overseas and such forth that the CIA does have to do, and I don't think that's an appropriate thing to discuss in public.
Robert Gates is President Bush's nominee to head the CIA. Now, he worked very closely with you. He was your executive assistant, and he worked very closely with your successor, William Casey. What kind of CIA director do you think Robert Gates would make?
Robert Gates is eminently qualified for the job by his background, by his close association with our president and his staff, and by the fact, incidentally, that he's a Soviet expert at a time when it's going to be necessary to lead the CIA away from as intense an interest in the Soviet Union as it's had for the past 46 years. On the other hand, Mr. Gates would come to the job, if he's confirmed, with a unfortunate cloud over his head of having been associated with Mr. Casey. And as long as that exists, he has a handicap there. So there are pluses and minuses for him, but only the Senate in its wisdom can determine whether those clouds that hang there because of the Casey regime outweigh the other strengths that Mr. Gates would bring to the job.
Now, Gates says he didn't know anything about the Iran-Contra deal, but do you find it credible that somebody as high up as he was within the CIA could not have known about it?
As we discussed earlier, Mr. Casey's style of management was so unique that I find it difficult to answer that question frankly. That is, I can't imagine under my tenure my deputy not knowing something as important as that went on. I felt it was my responsibility to keep him posted, even if he were not highly involved in a particular situation. But heavens, I could have died overnight, and he would have had to pick up the reins. But Mr. Casey's style was entirely different and rooted in a false sense of secrecy, in my opinion, or greater sense of secrecy than necessary, I think would be a better way to put it. And he may have bypassed his deputy.
I'd like to know if you get personally angry when there's a scandal like this involving the CIA, as someone who formerly headed it.
Oh, I get very disappointed. When I left the CIA, I felt that we had established standards of ethics, standards of legality, that the people understood that, and yet I find that very quickly Mr. Casey was able to ferret out at least a handful of people who were willing to break the law, like lying to the Congress or carrying out covert actions without presidential authorization, and to work around the system, to fail to inform the Congress adequately. I find it very disturbing and very disappointing, because it all happened so quickly. I take consolation now, however, that when Mr. Webster came in 1987, he's turned back the clock, and most of the reforms that we instituted in the Carter period have been reestablished now. It's unfortunate there was this derailment for 6 years, which has again cast a great shadow in the American public's mind over the CIA. I was on a college campus not too long ago and almost was shouted off when I went to make my scheduled speech. That's very disturbing to me in 1990, 1991. That should be behind us by now. The investigations of the CIA were back in 75, 76.
You've written a new book, Terrorism and Democracy. It's the second book you've written since you left the position of head of Central Intelligence. When you write a book, you have to submit it to the CIA, right?
Yes.
For CIA review, and they have the right to censor it. They have the right to tell you you can't reveal something.
Yes, let's be sure we understand the word censor, though. They're only supposed to take out things that are secret. They're not supposed to take out any criticism of the CIA or anything else like that.
Well, how has the review process worked for your two books? Have you been satisfied with the process?
Not at all. The first book, it was terrible. It was costly, took tremendous amounts of my time, and it ended up with removing material from the book that was totally unnecessary. I was not allowed, for instance, to quote one of my own speeches to an unclassified audience when I was in the CIA. One of the major things they wouldn't let me say in the book was that we use our satellites to take pictures in foreign countries. They said I could only admit we took pictures of objects associated with arms control agreements. 4 months after my book was published, the CIA made this same statement themselves in public, so it obviously wasn't very important to them. The second book, when the administration had changed at the CIA...
The first book was under Casey.
Yes, from Casey to Webster, everything went very smoothly.
How many things did they have you change in the second book?
Oh, I think there are only a couple of any significance in all, and I don't feel that it's deprived the book of anything substantial.
Now, wasn't it you that instituted the review process?
No, I was in long before my time. I was the first director to take someone to court to enforce the agreement. A man named Frank Snepp, after looking me in the eye and saying, "Yes, Mr. Director, I will submit my book for clearance to you," published it clandestinely and without coming to us for any clearance. Had we not done anything about Snepp and his book, the entire agreement would have been worthless from then on. So I went to the Attorney General and said, in order to uphold this agreement, which I think is a reasonable one, we ought to take Mr. Snepp to court, and we did.
What was the outcome?
He lost all of the profits from his book.
Did it set the precedent you wanted to set?
Yes. Yes, it did.
Did it feel different to be on the author end of the review process than it did on the CIA end of it?
Oh, yes. And lots of people say, well, Turner, you got hoist by your own petard. That isn't quite the case.
Actually, Frank Snepp said that.
He did?
Yes.
Well, you see, the difference is that I did submit my book. Snepp did not. I was hoist on the petard of a very unfair review process done under the Casey administration, where there was just this phobia about secrecy. And that abuse can take place with almost any regulation. This regulation itself is not inherently bad. I think it can be improved in several ways, but it's not something that we should dispense with. But it can be abused, and it was under Mr. Casey.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. I appreciate your doing it.
Former CIA Director Stansfield Turner. His new book is Terrorism and Democracy. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. the Bank of Credit and Commerce International has been the bank for terrorists, dictators, drug lords, arms merchants, and covert operations. The BCCI also had an activist wing that used bribery, blackmail, and violence to get what it wanted. And this wing started initiating arms deals of its own. The story of this so-called black network was broken by Time magazine reporter Jonathan Beatty. Coming up, we talk with Beatty about this banking conspiracy. 10 years ago, if you wanted rock and roll, you turned on your radio. Since then, if you wanted rock and roll, you could also turn on your TV. TV critic David Bianculli shares his thoughts on the 10th anniversary of MTV. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Israel has agreed to attend a regional peace conference if a compromise can be reached on who can represent the Palestinians. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Israel's answer came after just an hour and a half meeting between Secretary Baker and the Israeli Prime Minister and Foreign and Defense Ministers. Prime Minister Shamir said he would ask the cabinet to approve the decision to go to the peace conference scheduled for October. Baker, who has spent much of the last 6 months shuttling between Israel and Arab capitals, was extremely pleased with Shamir's answer.
That is the yes we were hoping for from the Israelis, yes, sir.
But the yes is dependent on finding a group of Palestinians that Israel is willing to sit down and talk to. Shamir's yes puts the pressure on the Palestinians to make concessions and say yes, too. Baker meets with Palestinians tomorrow to try to get this answer. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Bad weather interfered with liftoff plans at Cape Canaveral this morning, and launch of the space shuttle Atlantis was postponed for at least one day. High winds and clouds delayed launch until at least tomorrow morning. Liftoff is already 9 days behind schedule because of equipment problems. On Capitol Hill, the Senate has refused to pare down plans for a $4.6 billion anti-missile defense system. Senators turned down repeated amendments to cut funding for the scale-back so-called Star Wars plan. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold has more on the story.
Late last night and all day today, the Senate debated various measures aimed at cutting back SDI, just one part of the overall $290 billion defense authorization bill. Opponents of the ground-based anti-missile system argued that the ultimate goal of the legislation is additional sites, which would be in conflict with the 1972 U.S.-Soviet anti-ballistic missile treaty. Senator Joseph Biden.
We're going on record as saying we don't any longer think the ABM treaty, the bedrock of arms control, the philosophy upon which everything else has been built, makes sense anymore.
Senators voted repeatedly against measures aimed at cutting back the defense system, but approved a feel-good amendment stating that nothing in the defense bill authorizes violation of the ABM treaty. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
Two rockets hit a UN buffer force camp in southern Lebanon today. No one was injured in the pre-dawn attack, but the kitchen of the camp was destroyed. Earlier, there had been local protests that the troops were not protecting the area from militia attacks. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 7 points to close at 3,017.67 on volume of 170 million shares. Declining issues led advances 4-3. This is NPR News. President Bush is now on his way home after a 3-day trip to the Soviet Union. This morning in Kiev, Mr. Bush backed efforts by Soviet leader Gorbachev to hold the Soviet Union together and said that Washington would not take sides between republics who go it alone and Moscow. The president endorsed Gorbachev's efforts to secure approval from 9 of the Soviet republics for a new treaty, creating a federation with a high degree of independence for local governments. In South Africa, the African National Congress has rejected President F.W. de Klerk's response to the scandal surrounding covert government funding of Chief Buthelezi's Inkatha movement. NPR's John Madison reports from Johannesburg.
The ANC gave its first official reaction to the scandal and the decision of President de Klerk to demote his two most controversial cabinet ministers in an effort to put the two-week-old scandal behind him. Spokesman said that at the heart of the crisis was that the de Klerk government lacks credibility. A government that supported political parties while trying to start negotiations for a new constitution proved it could not be both player and referee at the same time. The ANC repeated its demand that the government freeze all secret funds and open them to public scrutiny. Meanwhile, it's decided not to enter government-run constitutional talks. Instead, its primary focus will be the removal of the government in consultation with other political parties and its replacement with an interim government of national unity. The ANC will call an all-party conference soon to try and implement this plan. I'm John Matteson in Johannesburg.
In Yugoslavia, the president of Croatia has announced a call-up of all reserve forces. Several people are said to have been killed in the latest round of fighting centered on two border towns. This continued violence could hamper efforts by the European community to work out a ceasefire. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The BCCI story is enough to make your average conspiracy freak seem rational. The Bank of Credit and Commerce International appears to be the largest corporate criminal enterprise ever. It was the place to bank if you were a terrorist, arms dealer, drug baron, or if you were running a covert operation. Its list of clients included world leaders, intelligence agencies, not to mention the Medellin drug cartel. But this bank also had an activist wing, a so-called black network that initiated arms and drug deals of its own and made offers that couldn't be refused. My guest Jonathan Beatty is one of two reporters who broke the story of this black network in Time magazine. The BCCI was seized in early July by international regulators, but Beatty says the black network is still functioning. One of the services the BCCI offered was to help dictators loot their country's treasuries. I asked Beatty how they did it.
Let's take the case of Noriega. Noriega had BCCI set up accounts for him under the names of the Panamanian National Guard, the Panamanian Security Forces, and even one particular account for the Panamanian National Treasury. Those are governmental accounts. But then BCCI would transfer that money to dummy accounts held by Noriega in London, thereby siphoning millions of dollars out of the country and into his private pocket. And presumably, BCCI gets a handsome cut of this. That's how they made their money.
Can you give us an example of how drug traffickers use the BCCI?
Well, the clearest example is actually pretty well known, Terry. When the customs undercover agents first stumbled across BCCI, clear back in 1986, they were laundering, in a sting operation, they were laundering drug money. And BCCI bankers, and they put some through BCCI in Miami, and the bankers came to them and said, "Hey, you guys, we can tell that you're laundering money, and we're not going to blow the whistle on you. What we're here to tell you is that there are a lot smarter ways to do it than you're doing it. If you want to work with us, we'll show you how it's really done." And then they literally took the drug money, which was really being handled by the undercover agents, and ran it around the world, made it disappear in various accounts, and then loaned it back to the agents again through regular business banking loans, so they had some legitimate answer for why they had the money in their hands. That's what they were doing for all of their clients. They not only made your money disappear or got it out of the country for you, and they also dealt in the movements of cash and gold, which is generally illegal. Anyhow, they just had wondrous ways to, again, more than just launder your money, but legitimize it. They would set up companies for you so that there was some paper trail to authorities showing you had some quasi-legitimate reason for having the money.
How much do we know about how American intelligence agencies used the BCCI?
Well, all this is just now coming out, Terry. What we do know is that the CIA used the bank for various covert accounts. We have been told by U.S. government sources that the DIA maintained a slush fund, which is different than just having accounts that, to pay for operations. By slush fund, as we understand it, we're being told about something that's off the books, off the reservation. Words that we heard back from Iran-Contra. our sources, Time Magazine sources, who have been affiliated with the bank's so-called black network, its clandestine arm, have told us that they worked closely with the CIA, with the Mossad, and with other intelligence agencies on, I mean, they actually got into the operations of moving arms and money and supposedly, reportedly, drugs around the world in conjunction with different agencies. They claim, the members do, the former participants, that they actually went out on virtual training exercises with the CIA in Pakistan. So there's a lot to get to the bottom of here.
Now, you broke the story of the BCCI's black network. Give us a synopsis of what the black network did.
The black network, as it's explained to us, is about, it's still in operation, about 1,500 people strong. It operated out of Karachi, Pakistan. When I say it operated, it was the orders came out of there. They had agents, their own agents around the world. It's more and more appearing that BCCI was less a bank than a purposeful front for a lot of other activities. And the black network people were the ones in the bank responsible for running these other activities, heavily into the international clandestine arms trade. BCCI acted as a broker, financier, between, for example, countries that didn't want anybody to know that they were selling arms to one another. But BCCI would also move these arms. They had a shipping company, a huge shipping company, that they controlled. So they were really acting as a full-service bank.
My guest is Jonathan Beatty. He's covering the BCCI scandal for Time Magazine. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Time Magazine reporter Jonathan Beatty is my guest. Can you give us some examples of the kind of operations that the Black Network ran, its own drug and weapons and currency deals?
Sure. The Black Network appeared, as we understand it now, to get more and more powerful within the bank. And we're told clearly that it used bribery, extortion, blackmail, even murder, to further the ends of the bank, and increasingly perhaps to further its own ends. But they would kidnap people, I mean, and hold them to ransom, so to speak, for commercial ventures. They told us that they sought to extract military secrets, industrial secrets, and banking and commercial secrets from people that they would try to get into their power. They would follow people with private detectives and learn everything about their lives so that they could step in and either lure or seduce somebody into betraying whomever he worked for. Or they would use blackmail to do it. We really haven't seen anything like this in the commercial world before. And in some of these activities, it said that they were working hand in hand with some agents. They traded favors and information with intelligence agencies and thus bought themselves a lot of immunity.
So the Black Network used killing, extortion, bribery to get information it wanted and to get clients it wanted as well?
Sure. They would begin putting money into somebody's bank account with electronic transfers, hundreds of thousands of dollars, as just an introduction to somebody that they wanted to, I use the word seduce again. They wanted people in power on their payroll. The modus operandi of this bank, and the Black Network was the instrument of this, was to achieve control or at least immunity in every country that they operated in, and they were in 72 countries. They made deals with leaders of countries, with the top politicians, sometimes with the presidents or the dictators directly of the country. In the United States, they bought their way into the United States. They have given former President Carter at least $8 million and perhaps much more than that under the name of contributions to his charities and to his library. And you can see this pattern repeated throughout the country. When they wanted to open a branch in India, they created a huge philanthropic award that Mrs. Gandhi could administer, and lo and behold, they got the licenses to. Anyhow, you can give examples of this everywhere.
When they give $8 million to, you know, former President Carter's philanthropies, does that mean that Carter necessarily knows who they are and what the BCCI is about, or did they maybe just want to associate themselves with a former American president to help themselves look good and legitimate?
Well, when they started associating themselves, he wasn't a former American president. The BCCI insinuated itself over the objections of American banking regulators into the United States during the Carter administration, and they used Burt Lance as their spearhead. They bought the National Bank of Georgia from Burt, using a dummy front to do it, and then, of course, later turned around and bought what became First American Bank, headquartered in Washington and run by Clark Clifford, as part of their hidden expansion into the United States. It is true that money that went to Carter did not go to Carter until after he was out of office, but it was almost an instantaneous transformation. It is as if President Carter gave up Air Force One day and then started flying about the world in the BCCI's largest corporate jet the next. One other thing to say is that we've tried to talk to President Carter about this. He's always been very defensive of Hassan Abedi, the founder of the bank, and their relationship, their friends. Now, Abedi had a vision of a third world bank that obviously appealed to somebody's with President Carter's sensitivities for the third world. But we tried to talk to Carter about it, and he would not talk at all. And one of the questions we had is, why did he continue to take money, or his foundations continued to take money from Abedi and the bank after the bank was convicted of laundering drug money in the United States? A question that's still not answered.
You broke the story of the BCCI's black network. How did you get onto that part of the story?
Old sources, I would say. And what it was I met with Jack Blum, who is the former special counsel for the Senate Foreign Relations Subcommittee on Narcotics and Terrorism. That's Senator John Kerry from Massachusetts committee. They were the first ones to come across BCCI, first ones with a public orientation that came across BCCI and the American government. And to make a very complicated story abbreviated, Jack Blum found some BCCI officers who were willing to talk and arranged that they talk in front of, not in front of, but while being taped by U.S. Customs and IRS and the U.S. Justice Department were all there to hear these revelations. And the bankers, this is in 1988, these BCCI bankers talked in specifics about how BCCI really secretly owned First American Bank and that Clifford was their lawyer. And they talked about drug dealing and they talked about many, many payments to American politicians to further their ways. These tape recordings were bottled up by the federal government. They never, ever appeared again. There was no action taken on them. Jack came back from this rendezvous with the feds to find that his job had suddenly been eliminated and he was no longer special counsel to Kerry's committee. And he waited for something to happen for about 6 months, and he finally despaired that the federal government was going to do anything. He traveled to New York and told his story and what he knew to Robert Morgenthau, the district attorney of New York, who just this week has indicted BCCI. And shortly after that, Jack met me and told me what had happened to him and the disappearance of the evidence. And that was the beginning of the story as far as Time magazine was concerned. That was in February.
One of the things I find almost amusing about the BCCI story is that all these enemies were kind of banking together. You know, you've got, like, possible clients include Israel and the PLO and Saudi Arabia and Syria. You've got Colombian drug baron Saddam Hussein, Ferdinand Marcos, Manuel Noriega. You know, it's like the whole political spectrum, shopping, you know, banking together in the same place.
That you've just now, Terry, absolutely defined why the bank existed and why it had so many customers. The people in our government, somebody in our intelligence community pointed out to me the other day that this bank formed an indispensable role in Middle Eastern intrigue and really intrigue around the world. Lots of people found a use for this bank, and that usefulness, by the way, was maintained only when all of these people, including our government, managed to keep one hand over their eyes so officially they didn't have to see this bank and what it was doing, because they were using it too.
Jonathan Beatty is a reporter for Time magazine. He and S.C. Gwynn broke the story of the BCCI's Black Network in the July 29th issue. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. Israel agrees in principle to a Mideast peace conference to be held in October. The Palestinians say they will have to be represented and should choose their own delegates to that conference. Two moments of reflection tonight. Former air traffic controllers recall their strike effort 10 years ago, and Peace Corps volunteers talk about their experiences on the occasion of the 30th anniversary of the founding of the Peace Corps. Also, the story of a dog, a police dog that was lost in the woods. The police were helped by a woman who claimed to be psychic, and the dog was found after 60 hours, dehydrated but otherwise okay, and the police give all the credit to the psychic woman.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. MTV is celebrating its 10th anniversary today. And TV critic David Bianculli says as it gets older, MTV gets bitter.
And we have got lots of ands in our fourth and final hour of Awake. We got a hit block featuring the CNC Music Factory, even though they use the ampersand. A rock block with driving crying, sort of an and. And right now it's a club block with the dynamic duo of rap Salt or Salt and Peppa. This is Do You Want Me?
That's what MTV sounds like now, but I remember MTV then. I was a TV critic in Akron, Ohio, watching carefully when MTV was launched at midnight on August 1, 1981. The first image was of a lunar landing and two astronauts planting a flag on the moon. On the flag, superimposed, was the colorful MTV logo. An announcer said, "Ladies and gentlemen, rock and roll." And MTV played its first music video. It was a song by the Buggles. For a while, MTV built momentum from the novelty of a 24-hour video jukebox channel, but the novelty wore off fast. How many times could you watch the same video from Journey or listen to the dumb, dumb music of Duran Duran? MTV's playlist was as narrow as its thinking. The original VJs had no personality, and the music chosen had no range. MTV, in fact, had to be coerced by CBS Records into playing a video by one of its black artists. MTV said the artist didn't quite fit its format, but CBS said it would withhold all clips by other CBS artists unless MTV gave in. So, reluctantly at first, MTV made room for this. Billie Jean shot Michael Jackson and MTV into the major leagues. But it was actually Jackson's next video, Beat It, that changed MTV for good. Styled after West Side Story, it introduced group choreography to music video in a big way, a way that's supported thousands of dancers ever since. As for the rest of MTV's impact, you can see it on TV anywhere, anytime, with the possible exception of C-SPAN. Arty commercials, Miami Vice. But 5 years ago, despite its impact, MTV was stagnating. It was choking on its own familiar formula of music, music, and more music, but only certain types of music. At age 10, things are a lot different at MTV. The tolerance for diverse musical styles has increased a lot. The mainstream success of the show Yo! MTV Raps taught MTV a valuable lesson. And MTV, which once refused to replace videos with other programs, now does it daily. There's an MTV game show, Remote Control, and an MTV animation show, Liquid Television, a terrific import from England. MTV now has music news and documentaries from Kurt Loder, and, best of all, it's got Unplugged, an acoustic music series that has attracted such artists as Paul McCartney, Sting, Aerosmith, and this band.
This is Mike Mills, Bill Berry, Peter Buck, Peter Holzapfel. I'm Michael Stipe. We are REM. Here we go. Here's a song.
1, 2, 3, 4. They're going wild. The call came in early morning, pre-dawn. The followers of chaos out of control.
Don't get me wrong, MTV still has a long way to go. It's still too sexist, too silly, and way too self-promotional. But some genuine artists, musical and visual, have gotten their big breaks from MTV. A cable channel that can bring back the Monkees as a TV series and a group is not to be trifled with. These days, thank goodness, music television seems to be paying more attention to the music.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. Here's a current MTV hit.
You said loud and I heard you. Hurt you. Some say I'm old-fashioned. I like to take my time and do it slow, you know, with the flow. But don't try to rush it, though. Ride it like a horse and let nature take its course. Get to know each other. Be my friend, not just my lover. Share your thoughts with me.
Our reviews and interviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Joan Tuohy and Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
History is being constantly revised. The past few years have brought us several unflattering biographies of Lyndon Johnson. On the next Fresh Air, Robert Dalek talks with us about his new biography of the former president, which shows Johnson as a scoundrel who was also a brilliant politician and a visionary. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
I'm your host, Wayne Connor. Won't you come to the opera with me? Sundays at 1 p.m. on WHYY-FM, Philadelphia.
Israel agrees to a peace conference, but with a big if.
This is All Things Considered from National Public Radio.